Welcome to a sound effect podcast, the podcast about sound effects.
I'm Asbjørn Andersen from asoundeffect.com.
And I'm Christian Halskjær.
Welcome to another episode of the sound effect podcast. Christian, what do you have in store for us for this one?
Well, I have been talking to Stosh Tyshinsky from Collected Transients, who fairly recently released the library Thermal Flux, which is a collection of recordings of different metal objects heated to extreme temperatures. We'll be talking about his background as a sound designer and, of course, about the library, how he did it, and any exciting details from that. So that's pretty much it.
Very cool. Hot.
Extremely hot.
That's awesome. I look forward to hearing that. But before we get to that, let's have a listen to some of the latest sound effect libraries from the independent sound community.
The Complete Amusement Park Sound Effects Bundle is two different libraries. One consists of roller coasters whooshing by on their tracks with lots of grueling screams. The other library features recordings of various other amusement rides. In total, you get 15 gigabytes of sounds here, so check it out. Another bundle is Huge Hidden Structures from Red Libraries. Here are sounds of secret passages and doorways in ancient temples and tombs, perhaps. You can choose between two versions, designed and toolbox, or get them together as a bundle. Sounds are 24-bit 96 kHz to 192 kHz, so let's have a listen. Yet another release that comes in different versions is Medieval Life from Boom Library. In this one, you get all the sounds you need for creating a medieval environment. This includes coverage of everything from marketplaces to individual elements like tools and such. Going for the whole package, you will get almost 45 gigabytes of sound. Finally, we have Future Weapons 3 from Soundmorph. This is over 1 gigabyte of weapons with names like Acid Handgun, Laser Submachine Gun, and my favorite, the Venom Spitter. All in all, 1.2 gigabytes of sounds and 24-bit 96 kHz and with metadata. So let's hear what that sounds like. Many of you probably know the sound effects company Collected Transients, which recently released the library Thermal Flux. And it so happens that I have with me here today the owner and recordist, Stosh Tyshinsky. And welcome, Stosh.
Hi, Christian. Thanks for having me on the podcast. I love all the articles you guys put out, and I love the podcast. So hopefully I can live up to the rest of the content.
Yeah, don't worry about that. We're pretty ruthless editors here, so... But with that aside, could you start by telling us a little bit about who you are and how you got into sound?
Okay, so if I were to put one title on myself, I guess it would be sound designer. I'm a sound designer based in Chicago. I currently work at a post-audio house called Noiseplore. A lot of my work is designing sounds for commercials, TV shows, games, films. I do a lot of session work, recording VO, ADR, mixing with clients and all that good stuff. And of course, I also run Collected Transients, where I create sound effects libraries. So in my free time, I'm either out recording stuff, editing stuff at home, or breaking my website. So how did I get into sound? Well, I guess like a lot of people in my field, it sort of started with me wanting to make music. That actually kind of started with Fruity Loops, if you remember that.
Yeah.
But really, it kind of took off when I found out about Reason. I definitely wouldn't say the music I was making was amazing, but, you know, I had fun doing it. But I bring up Reason because that's kind of where I discovered that I really liked the creative and technical sides of, you know, sampling, synthesis, and I guess audio in general. So one of the really cool things about Reason is you can literally flip the entire virtual rack around and pretty much patch any device to anything else with virtual cables. It's really sort of very malleable, and that's kind of the part I think I enjoyed more than probably making the music itself. Yeah, so after a while, the music thing kind of went stale, but I was a senior in high school, and I hadn't figured out what I wanted to do after graduation. I didn't really have much of a passion for any career path in particular at the time, but my girlfriend, she was looking around for schools, and she wanted to get into marketing. So she was looking at a school called Columbia College Chicago, and she saw that they offered a degree called Audio for Visual Media. So she told me about it. I researched it, and I sort of thought, well, people don't actually make a living doing this stuff, right? I mean, it sounded cool, but I didn't see it as too much of a viable option. But nevertheless, we went to an open house, and that's really all it took. I was sold. I met with graduates and teachers, people at the school who were making a living in audio. You know, they were working at agencies, post-production houses, freelance, everything. So yeah, I ended up applying. I got accepted. I moved to Chicago, went to school, and I really enjoyed it. The classes were great. Overall, a really good experience. And one of my friends, by the way, is really sort of the reason I'm working where I am today. He was interning at a post house, Noiseplore, here in Chicago. And one day he texted me asking if I wanted to come by and see the place. So I went with him one morning. But from the context of our conversations, I was kind of thinking this is just going to be a quick tour, but it turns out it wasn't that at all. I did get a quick tour, but at the end I met with the two owners, and they pretty much asked me on the spot, do you want to intern here? And of course I said yes, and we had kind of the most informal interview I've ever had in my life. But in the end, apparently everyone was happy because I got the gig. So I was there grabbing coffee and cutting sound effects for a few days a week, and one thing led to another, and eventually I convinced them to pay me. So, you know, I stayed on a bit longer than most interns, and I always joked with them that I wasn't going to leave until they paid me. And here I am today, what, about 5-6 years later, still here. So I guess it worked out. So yeah, that's how I got into audio, and I think getting into recording sound effects was really a pretty natural progression from there. I bought my first recorder, a Zoom H4N, and recorded everything I possibly could. And it was really, you know, me discovering how gratifying it was to use my own personally recorded stuff on, you know, commercials and films and stuff like that. It was just a very rewarding experience. So it's just something I picked up on and I wanted to share with the world.
Right. So thermal flux, what we're dying to know here is, how did you come up with that idea?
Man, you could ask me that about any of my other libraries, and I don't think I could give you a specific answer. But for this one, I can. So the idea for thermal flux literally came from me watching one single video on YouTube. There's a user called Cars and Water on YouTube who sort of blew up from like a 30-second clip of him taking a red-hot nickel ball and dropping it into a cup of water. That's literally it. It's got like 10 million views now or something, and that's all he does now. But anyways, I saw the video, and I guess I didn't mention, it makes a freaking crazy sound. Like, the ball isn't perfectly round, so it sort of vibrates and pings around in the cup as the water cools it. But anyways, I saw that video, and it got me thinking, really high temperature, really cool sound. So I did a lot of searching around for potentially cool sounding hot and cold things that I could realistically record myself. And over a period of maybe 5 or 6 months, I bought a ton of props, you know, torches, dry ice, different metals, and I recorded everything I could come up with. So yeah, that's how the idea of thermal flux came about.
Okay, so fire and very, very hot objects in the studio. How did that go? Any accidents or exciting situations?
Yeah, that was quite the process. one of the scariest things about recording a lot of it here at Noise Floor is that this building has the old-style sprinkler heads, where if one single head is triggered, the entire building is also triggered, and literally everything is flooded with water. I did have a few accidents, nothing serious, but I guess I can share. So at Noise Floor, I was melting aluminum in glass, I think it was, and pouring it into a metal bowl filled with water. And everything was going great. In fact, the whole record went great. Stuff was sounding awesome, and nothing fell on the floor, no fires, no injuries or anything like that. And then at the end of the day, I was packing stuff up, and I went to pick up the bowl so I could pour out the water. And I realized it was stuck to the wooden table I was sitting on. And I sort of thought, oh, maybe it's just a sticky spot on the table or something. So I pulled a bit harder, and the bowl came off, and I realized the bowl had burned a nice kind of little circle into the wood on the table. Yeah, it wasn't too bad, but somehow I spent the whole time recording the stuff, you know, freaking 1900 degree melting glass, and I never thought about the fact that this heat had to be going somewhere. And in this case, it was into the water and into the metal on the bowl itself. So yeah, that was a fun one to explain to the owners. They weren't, you know, upset or anything. It was just they were more amused at what I was recording. At home, I broke a glass pitcher with some molten aluminum, similar situation. I wasn't really thinking about how hot the stuff I was dealing with was. I'd already done a test pour into the pitcher, and it held up fine, and so I got to recording. But the second record, I poured in the aluminum. It started to solidify, and then all of a sudden, the entire pitcher cracked right down the middle, like instantly. And luckily, it didn't fall apart, but water started to leak all over the place, and that sort of freaked me out. So I quickly moved to set down the ladle, which I was melting the aluminum in, without realizing there was still a little bit in there. So a tiny drop flew onto the floor and caused a nice little surface burn. Luckily, it had already cooled a lot, and I had wet rags ready in case something like that happened. But that's the thing with aluminum. I'm not sure if it's just that it melts at such a high temperature or something, but once it's molten, it stays that way for a considerable time. Even in water, it's really cool to see it. It stays molten in water for a few seconds before it even starts to solidify. But yeah, there were a lot of other very minor accidents, but I guess those are the highlights.
Well, accidents are always exciting, right? So what did you do in terms of safety? I'm thinking about you're in a studio and you know, expensive equipment and...
Yeah, so accidents are bad, but they can really be bad when they're in a studio with all kinds of expensive equipment that's not yours. So yeah, before any kind of recording began for each kind of thing I wanted to capture, I made sure to do a good amount of testing beforehand. I always wanted to be sure I knew exactly what to expect when it came to recording. Take, for instance, the red-hot ball bearings. I mean, in my opinion, I think that was the most dangerous thing I recorded. It may not seem like it, but what safer thing is there to heat up glowing hot and attempt to handle rather than a perfectly round, slippery ball bearing, you know? So I had to figure out how to heat and handle those safely. And at first I tried something similar to what the YouTube guy was doing. He had set up a 3-pronged screw type thing that the ball just kind of rests on. And at first that worked out fine. But I found out that over time the screws would bend ever so slightly from the heat. Not a lot, but enough that all it took was a little bump for the ball to come loose and fall onto the ground. Luckily, I found that out while I was testing. I was in the basement on a concrete floor near a drain, so I knew exactly where the ball was going to roll if it fell. So yeah, in the end, I ended up using a large ladle to set the ball in to heat it up. I used torches to heat up the ball, and the ladle worked out really well because it kind of kept all the heat directed at the ball rather than letting it fly past it in the air. So yeah, a lot of testing prior to any new kind of recording was the main thing. But in case something did happen, I always had a fire extinguisher within reach and generally a bunch of water and wet paper towels and stuff like that. But the one other concern for me was inhaling the gases that the stuff I was recording produced. Propane torches can produce carbon monoxide if it's not burning properly, which is very dangerous. And dry ice is just frozen CO2, which can also be dangerous if there's too much of it. Usually both of those things aren't a problem, but I was recording in small, perfectly sealed rooms. So I took a lot of breaks to fan and air out the rooms, and I mostly heated things up next to open windows. So I generally get whatever it was, sand, metal, glass, whatever, heated almost all the way up outside of the booth and walk in to finish the job.
Well, that sounds sensible. So did you discover any sort of microphone tricks that that work particularly well for this, do's and don'ts or whatever?
Yeah, so I first noticed it when I tried to record some sand crackling after I heated up. It was a really cool sound. But the only way to properly record it was to have a mic, you know, really close, directly above the ladle that the sand was in. And I quickly noticed, luckily, because I was monitoring at the time, that there was a huge low-frequency rumble whenever I put it under the mic. So I put two and two together, and I figured, you know, it was the heat. So I put my hand above the ladle and was amazed how much hot air was coming off of it. You know, even 2 or 3 feet away, the heat was enough that I could only keep my hand there for a few seconds at a time. So I never quite got that sand crackling sound, but my mic still worked, so that's good. From then on, I tried to make sure to never have the mics directly above the heat source. You know, always at an angle to it. And the easiest way for me to judge where the mic was safe was doing quick hand test. You know, if I couldn't hold my hand there for a long time, it probably wouldn't be a good idea to have the mic there for a long time. It was kind of the rule of thumb, I guess.
I would say that's a pretty good rule. So what surprised you the most about this? Did any of the sounds turn out better or worse than you had imagined? What were your negative and positive experiences here?
I thought the red hot ball bearing would give me a lot more variety than what it did. I actually recorded a ton more stuff than what ended up in the library, but so much of it sounded so similar. I tried the ball bearing on like deodorant, and it sounded exactly the same as putting it on soap. I tried glue, and it sounded just like syrup. Wet concrete sounded very similar to the drywall mud that I'd used. A lot of stuff like that happened. So one of the things I really try hard to do in my libraries is minimize things that don't sound unique from each other or the rest of the library. I really picked up on that from reading Paul Verostek's stuff. He's big on, you know, if what you're recording isn't unique among the rest of the stuff you have in your library, there's probably no need for it to be there. So yeah, I was also a little underwhelmed with how the hot ball bearing sounded on dry ice. Not that they're not cool recordings, it's just not at all what I expected it would sound like. I mean, it's like a 1400 degree Fahrenheit ball bearing and negative 100 degree dry ice. You sort of expect some crazy stuff to happen, but the ball kind of just rattled around a lot for a long time before it cooled down. But yeah, there were a lot more positive surprises than negative, though. For instance, I was amazed by the crazy sounds I got with the hot knife on water beads. There's just a crazy variety of sounds you can get. You know, obviously the hissing and sizzling from the water boiling in the beads, but also these crazy high-pitched whines and chattering sounds. Let's see. Probably the coolest surprise was the tin tings, that's fun to say, that I got. Before I tried the ball bearings on dry ice, I had tried putting tin on the dry ice, and it was a pretty cool sound, but it wasn't too different than any other metal on dry ice type sound. But anyways, I noticed as the tin started to cool after it had stopped vibrating against the dry ice, it started making this really, really light tinging sound as it cooled. I mean, it was so strange and unexpected, and I'm not sure what causes it, unfortunately, but yeah, super happy for that surprise.
Yeah, well, they certainly are interesting sounds. I guess you never really know what happens unless you experiment the way you did. So I was wondering, who inspires you? We've heard about how you got inspiration for this particular library, but who inspires you as a sound designer or in your work in general?
Well, when it comes to sound design, it's honestly, I think, mostly the people I work with. Thinking back, one of the most useful things I learned was from my boss. One of my bosses, Jamie Vanadia. One day I was mixing away some commercial I designed, and he walked in. He heard me trying to mix in some sound effect that I created, and he asked me why I was making that particular sound so quiet. And I tried to answer with something like, well, it's supposed to be subtle or something like that. To make a long story short, he really got me to realize that if you're going to have design in a spot, it should be heard. You know, not to say that design should always take precedence or it needs to be loud or whatever, but if it's there, it should be heard. It should be recognized. So if you're starting to mix some sound effect way, way down, there's two things. It probably doesn't really need to be there, or maybe the sound you came up with isn't the right sound and you need to try again. So that alone really changed the way I take on designing stuff. I always try to make sure each sound, or each layer really, I guess, has a purpose. You know, sometimes I'll be designing something and realize I've lowered some element of it so much that you can't hear it at all compared to everything else in the sound. So when it gets to that point, I try to stop and reevaluate. Usually I end up just killing that layer and moving on, and I think it's helped me a ton. It's definitely lowered my track count, which is good. But yeah, definitely the people I work with, I guess, is the main thing. We have a really collaborative environment here, so every one of us is always feeding off each other with new tricks and ideas and really everything. But for sound effects libraries, if I had to pick out one, it'd be Tim Preble from Hiss and a Roar. He does such a great job at taking normal things and making them very unique. I mean, there's too many libraries of his to name, but one that comes to mind is his real-life granular library. He takes a bunch of normal, boring, I guess, stuff, rocks, beads, rice, and comes up with some really abstract-sounding stuff. It's just really refreshing to have someone take an object that probably hundreds of people have recorded and see a completely new take on it that sounds like nothing else you've ever heard. And, oh yeah, he makes really cool videos too.
yeah, he does. So, what's next for you and for Collected Transients? Can you share a little bit?
Well, for the short term, I think you can expect more of these abstract, kind of built for sound design, as I like to say, libraries. I really enjoy coming up with them, and people seem to really like them. I think that a lot of sound designers like me, they're always hungry for unique source material to work with, you know? If it's something that no one has ever recorded before and it sounds cool or crazy or just weird, that's probably a good place to start. So I also have a couple big picture type libraries that I want to record, more practical use type stuff. But they're both very difficult ones to record. So without going into a lot of detail, one has to do with a particular kind of car sound effect that I think is sorely missing from car libraries. And the other has to do with a very particular type of crowd recording. So, but yeah, both things, very practical use type stuff and things that I think would make sound designers' lives a lot easier. Another thing to expect is the quality of recordings going up. Literally every penny that I've made from selling collected transients libraries has gone directly back into it, purchasing equipment, props, hosting, all that good stuff, and I continue to do that. So with the release of Thermal Flux, I'm finally comfortable enough to pick up some mics that I've been dying to get, a pair of Sennheiser 8040s. So I'm crazy excited to use those in my next library, but yeah, I guess I'd say, you know, expect just that. I'm going to keep reinvesting into collected transients, so hopefully each release is better than the last.
Well, that sounds like a very good long-term strategy, I would say. But anyway, Stosh, it's been great having you and hearing about what you do and how you do it, and thanks a lot for your time.
All right, Christian. Thanks so much. It was great chatting with you, and I hope we chat again soon. Bye.
Wow, that was a great interview. Thanks a lot, Christian and Stosh, for sharing the story behind the library, and what a cool library as well. That's all we have for this episode. Thanks a lot for listening. See you next time.
Yeah, see ya.
Take care.